every time you log into Facebook, every time you send an email, every time you answer the phone, they know. They're gathering data. Are you okay with that? I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we talk about the psychology of privacy. Even before last month's leaks about intelligence operations, we all knew that everyone from the government to advertisers might have access to information we'd rather people not know. Sometimes we don't mind, sometimes we do. How come? And what about keeping secrets in this day and age? Is that something we value? Is it even possible anymore? Our resident psychologist will join us to let us in on what's really going on in our heads. So pass it along. Secrets and privacy. Today on Central Standard, after the news. When Edward Snowden leaked classified information last month, it disturbed many of us, and on multiple levels. Some were upset that a person entrusted with keeping secrets decided not to keep them anymore. Others, though, were more worried about the secrets themselves, the fact that our emails, our phone calls, they weren't as private as we thought. Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, we're taking a look at the psychology of privacy and of keeping secrets, not just the NSA kind of secrets, but secrets in the rest of our lives, too. Why does it offend us when someone keeps something secret or when they fail to do so? And in this day and age, even before we knew about those NSA programs, do any of us really expect privacy anymore? Joining us is our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Leese. Always good to have you here, Bruce.
It is my pleasure. I'm so glad to be back.
We're glad you're here. So maybe we need to start just by talking a little bit about the terms we're using. What is privacy and what is secrecy?
Privacy is the protection of one's own personal information. Privacy is meant to limit access to others. We don't want people to know things about us that are what we consider personal. That we don't want to be seen unclothed, literally and figuratively. And we certainly don't want people to have access to our finances and stuff like that.
So there's these categories of things that we say are private as opposed to public.
That is correct. That's a good way to look at it. So that's privacy. Secrecy it has a lot more intentionality to it. We assume certain things are private, but we work to keep things secret. Mm. We intentionally block others from knowing things about us for fear of controversy, the consequences being judged, or to put it simply, being ripped off.
Okay. So we'll talk about secrecy a little bit later here, but let's start by talking a little more about this idea of privacy, this protection of ourselves and our information. There's a constitutional and legal meaning for this word. We talk about a constitutional right to privacy, but in a more everyday sense, do you think people really expect a lot of privacy in their daily lives?
I don't think people think about it much. I think that when people go to a place that they're not used to, they may be more vigilant. If you're traveling before you get, you know, in the shower alone in your hotel room, you're more likely to lock the door. Mm-hmm. So the novelty of being someplace new is probably triggers thoughts about privacy. I think for the most part, we're busy thinking about other things.
Yeah. Where is it that we draw that line? You mentioned finances. Like there's certain things that we all sort of agree ought to be private. Where do we draw the line? Do most people agree should be private?
Well, I think it might be helpful to distinguish between the two domains where privacy is important or big or salient. Institutional privacy, and I kind of made these terms up, so I don't know that you'll find them anywhere. Institutional privacy and interpersonal privacy. Institutional privacy is privacy from those institutions, the government, advertisers, corporations, banks. Institutional privacy is keeping like our financial information and credit card numbers and those kinds of things private. So,
those nameless, faceless organizations.
Exactly. People who would sell us things, people who would take from us, people who we believe might take advantage of us. As just one a hot topic, I know that there is a group of gun owners who's very concerned about having to register as a gun owner. because they feel like institutions will be impinging upon their privacy and then influence their ownership of guns.
Well, and that's a good point. Do you feel like reasons to be concerned about privacy always have a reason? So, for example, the gun owner who's afraid the government might come and take their gun at some point. Or is it harder to name than that? Does there have to be a specific fear, or do you just feel like it should be private?
I think that that's one of the differences between institutional and interpersonal privacy. The interpersonal privacy is, we don't want to see our bodies naked. At least most of us don't want to see anyone to see our bodies
well,
naked.
Well, yeah, speak for yourself there.
We don't want people to know when we cry. We don't want people to know, when we're attracted to other people or when we're shamed. Those are much less tangible. They don't involve account numbers, and they don't involve what our favorite soap is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the intangibles tend to fall more into the category that I arbitrarily labeled interpersonal. So interpersonal privacy versus privacy from institutions, two related but different things.
Do you find that everyone is worried about privacy? Does everyone have the same level of feeling, please don't invade my personal information?
We all know from back in public school and perhaps college, we all know that that there's this thing called the bell curve or the normal curve. Average is in the middle, like, how you do on the test in math class. Average is in the middle, and then the outliers are, a high grade and a low grade. The same is true for human behavior, human thinking, human feelings. I think that there are, on average, people are, moderately concerned. It's not something they think about every day. There are people that fall into the category of paranoid that spend excessive amounts of time worrying about their privacy, worrying about protecting their secrets, worrying that people will know too much about them. I found it fascinating after I got to thinking about this interpersonal versus institutional privacy. As I poked around on the internet and looking at news sites and stuff, I wasn't aware until just yesterday that Edward Snowden very carefully protected his interpersonal privacy, too. There was a story about him probably in the Washington Post where somebody knocked on his door to introduce themselves to Edward Snowden as a neighbor, and he was cold and distant and pretty much closed the door as quick as he could.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that was his interpersonal privacy. So I think there are people who are very much afraid of their privacy being breached, institutional privacy. I don't want you to advertise to me. I don't want you to track my cookies on the internet. But they're not worried about interpersonal privacy and vice versa.
Do you feel like Edward Snowden is the exception rather than the rule? Or is there a little Edward Snowden in all of us that is inclined to say it is wrong for the government to know all these things and people ought to know that the government is doing it?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon to answer your question. I think all of us want control in our lives, and we fear losing control. And part of having control, knowledge is control, knowledge is power. To the extent that we know things, we have more knowledge and then power. And I think that most people want, they don't want somebody else crawling around in their information so that they can then possibly control their lives. I think, again, people more or less worry about that. And I think he worried about it as he was exposed to more and more government surveillance. He became increasingly worried about it. I don't imagine he got the job as the contractor originally interviewing, saying, I really don't like that the government pokes around in people's business.
Deep commitment to openness.
Right.
And yeah.
So, I think people, for the most part, want control. They want power over their own destiny, and they don't want other people poking around. But I don't think people think about it as much as as you might expect them to.
Well, let's find out if that's the case. Let's ask our listeners. How do you feel about your own privacy, especially in light of current events? Does it bother you that that government, or for that matter, advertisers, would find out some personal information about you? Or are you someone who says, hey, I have nothing to hide. I don't care. By all means, find it out. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Let us know how you feel about your own privacy and your right to have some information not be known. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're also streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison, and we're talking with Dr. Bruce Leese, who is our regular visitor from the world of psychology, talking about issues that matter today, privacy and secrecy. Bruce, how much privacy are people willing to give up in the name of security?
Apparently a lot at this point in time. The Patriot Act, which was passed in 2002, I believe.
Right after
9/11. Gave the government more control over, or more permission to poke around to see who might be threatening us.
And polls ever since have pretty much revealed that people are okay with that.
Yeah, I think people, I do feel people are, people believe that we are safer as a result. You know, it's interesting, more chilling than Edward Snowden's revelations, as far as I'm concerned, are the revelations in a book by Dana Priest and William Arkin of the Washington Post. They wrote the book Top Secret America. And if they weren't journalists and if they hadn't acquired their information and shared it legally, they shared, I think, way more than Edward Snowden could possibly share about the locations and sizes and shapes of all the government surveillance buildings. Anyone interested in how vast the network is of government surveillance should read that book. She's a reporter for the Washington Post, so she, I mean, this was published in the Post and then turned into a book. It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
So it sounds like, from what you've mentioned about how Americans feel about their security versus their privacy, that we're sort of two minds about this. That we're genuinely ambivalent. We have sort of a love-hate relationship with the idea that we have privacy.
Yeah, it is a love-hate relationship. The troubling thing about the Top Secret America book is that it talks about the redundancies and how much more exists out there than we really need, and how that becomes an impediment to our own privacy, because she claims we're kind of stumbling over ourselves trying to protect our own privacy. But getting back to what you said, we do have a love-hate relationship. We want protection, and we believe the more protection we have, the better. She argues, with William Arkin, she argues that that's not true, that the redundancy causes problems. But we want to believe, I want to believe, you want to believe that you're safe, that I want to believe I'm safe. And I think for the most part, you said it, it's true. Surveys show that people give up a lot to feel safe in this day and age.
You can tweet us your questions or comments. We're at KCURCST. You can also call us at 816-235-2888. That's what Philip in Midtown did. Philip, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi there. You actually have a series of questions, two of which you actually did ask. The first, of course, is how much privacy do people want? The other, you asked an interesting question, which is actually twofold. One, what should government be able to do? But the more important question that's raised by Snowden is what should we be able to know that government is doing? Because the real importance of what he did was reveal that there was a secret policy. And, you know, the real problem with secret policies is if you're in a democracy, if the voters and the citizens don't know what the government policy is, then they can't control the government. And that is seriously dangerous.
I'm sorry, Philip. Yeah, I appreciate that. Hang on. Let me ask Dr. Bruce Leese to respond. Dr. Leese, is there a significant difference between the government knowing things and our knowing that the government knows these things?
Again, it's interesting. This book by Priest and Arkin reveals way more than we ever imagined about the government's tactics for surveilling us. I mean, it's way more. It's unbelievable how much watching they're doing and how many resources are dedicated to watching what we do and what foreigners could do to us. You know, every time a voting cycle, every time there's an election cycle, one of the things you hear over and over again is that Americans are lazy. That's what you hear, that we don't want to do the research, that we don't want to know things. We just want to go to the polls and vote. I wonder if all of those policies were accessible and we could research them, I wonder how many people would do that work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we say we want to know what the government's policies are, and I'm not disagreeing with Philip at all, but who would do all the work to find – who would even read a book of that, like, 300 pages?
Well, and what do you make of that? Do you think the fact that people aren't reading that book in large numbers, or that we never really were so worried about this infringement until the Edward Snowden case, does that say that – I mean, psychologically speaking, this isn't really that big a deal to us?
The media seems to determine what's a big deal, not the individual anymore. It's kind of like we're told – what the big deal of du jour is, you know, the whole 24-hour news cycle and all that.
Yeah.
It's what's really important to individuals is safety and security and love and connectedness and relationships and generativity, the ability to go to work and make enough bucks to put food on the table and shelter. That's what people are primarily occupied with. They want to come home and relax. And not a lot of people run to the internet and say, I want to continue reading the government's policies on privacy. And we don't even read the privacy policies that are mailed to us. That'd be a good question. How many people read privacy policies? We don't. We're kind of lazy.
Let's talk to Cindy. Thanks, Philip, for the call. Cindy is in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi.
Hi, Cindy.
My comments are that I don't believe that all this security makes us safer. I think it's totally a guise to be able to snoop and spy on us. Ever since the Patriot Act, we have given away all these personal rights to our own personal security and privacy that I think we're responsible for. And to have Big Brother looking over my shoulder, I don't want to come off as paranoid because I'm not, but the fact is that they're there and they're watching, and why are they watching me? You know, I've got nothing to hide in that respect, but I don't think that, you know, I think it's a big sham that this all supposedly makes us safer.
But so then, Cindy, if I can press back, you said you're not being paranoid. Why do you think they are interested if it isn't about safety? What are they after?
Control. You know, this is a fear factor. This is how you control the population, is fear. Make them afraid that, you know, your next-door neighbor is a terrorist. You know, that's just crazy.
So it's to create an environment where then political aims can be. I see.
Absolutely. And that's how you control your population. That's how you get people to vote the way you want them to vote, is the fear factor. And sadly enough, the majority of Americans have bought into it.
Okay, Cindy, I appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much for the call. Dr. Bruce Leese, Cindy's probably not the only one who feels that way.
Well, the best argument for kind of the wrong reasons to do all this surveillance, the best argument is that politicians want to be reelected. And no politician has the spine to say we're doing too much surveillance because – I could quote any of a number of articles on this, they all say the same thing. The politician that has the courage to say we're doing more than we need to, we're overextending ourselves, the politician who has the courage to do that, the next day will have to face some kind of terrorist attack that they will then be blamed for. See, because Senator Joe Schmo said we should pull back security, that's, you know, of course we're going to get bombed that day.
Right.
So that's a good argument. A really, really solid argument for why there's too much being done is the argument that's too much redundancy and too much duplication. There are so many alphabet soup agencies that are doing surveillance that they're reproducing a lot of the same results with all of this activity, and that's a really good argument. And what's interesting is a lot of the government agencies are hiring – different government agencies are hiring some of the same contractors. So they're not going to get different answers from different contractors.
Right. Well, it's, there's a variety of perspectives out there. We've got Russ on the line from Kansas City, Missouri. Russ, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Hey, this surveillance program as delineated doesn't really bother me because it's not so much surveillance as archiving. It's like the difference between having a video recorder and just having a security guard watching the cameras. If you want to look at the past, the data has to be in some existent form somewhere to look at, and this data is by definition ephemeral. The phone companies don't keep it forever. If they want to get copies of this, keep them in a locked box somewhere, and if there's a reason to find out who called whom at what time 5 years ago as part of a current investigation, and there's a warrant based on the person who was called or whatever, I don't really see a problem with that, as long as the data is collected and stored safely and there so that it doesn't go away and we don't have it when we do need it. The Patriot Act disturbs me deeply, but this is not so much a matter of the Patriot Act as a matter of keeping old data that may one day prove useful. If not, it doesn't take up much space.
So, Russ, well, just let me ask you, if you haven't, you know, you haven't done anything wrong, you're not a criminal, you're not a spy, why does it not bother you that the government would be keeping this data about your personal life?
It does not bother me because no human is looking at it and deciding to target me with ads or deciding to look in my windows with a snorkel camera or whatever. It's a very large amount of data. And if somebody decides to, let's take a radical example, something that would directly impinge on me. Let us say that I own some firearms, nothing particular, it's a hunting rifle. Let's say one of those hunting rifles is stolen and I don't know it and is later used in a crime. It is conceivable that this could all impinge upon me unless I was, quite open and it's known that those things were known to other people instead of my keeping them a deep, dark secret. That's a bad example. But a good example with phone records would be, let's say the call that I made 8 years ago to Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia saying, hey, not all of us over here think that it's a great idea that we invaded Iraq. Just so you know, some of us, believe that somebody other than Americans has a right to have a country. I actually left them a voicemail to that effect. Somewhere along the line, they're going to probably look that up, and it's going to be found to be an innocent and non-dangerous call. But I want it on record in case I was a nut and just okay. Haven't popped yet.
So Russ, you're comfortable with a certain degree of invasion, if you will, of your own privacy because the government may need it at some point.
Well, quite frankly, companies such as Google or Amazon or Facebook have a lot more information of a different
right.
variety.
Which you've offered
and
voluntarily.
Well, I'm not on Facebook, but a lot of people are.
All right.
They're the exposure generation.
Russ, we really appreciate your call. Thanks for calling. Bruce, that's a pretty typical feeling out there, too.
Yeah, as Russ was talking, I was thinking, why do I not worry about the information the government has about me or Amazon has about me? Once in a while, I'll get a pop-up that spooks me a little. It's like, how did you know that I would be that interested in that? But
right. For
the most part, I don't think about it because, the important reason for being alive and on Earth is to make sense of life and to find meaning. As far as I'm concerned, we're on Earth to love well and to find meaning in our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think if I got too worried about whether the government was following me around and reading my notes or looking over my shoulder, I think if I got too worried about that, I'd lose track of the meaning of life. I would not have a satisfying life. So I give it enough attention to read to read this stuff on it, and then I know what I can and can't control in my life.
You sometimes hear this from companies like Google or Facebook that actually they're gathering data and so that they can offer you information,
<More meaning. laughs>
advertisements that are more meaningful to you.
You're right.
Things that are more relevant to your life. I mean, can you make an argument that we sacrifice a little bit of privacy in order to improve the quality of our life?
I mean, they make that argument. I wouldn't make that argument. It's interesting. I'm involved in the book club in Lawrence, and so because I've been buying a certain kind of pattern of books from Amazon, they're recommending all of these books that follow that pattern exactly.
Yeah,
and they haven't recommended one I've bought, not a single one. I still go back and buy the ones that I think would be good for our book club, but they aren't influencing me the way they want to, and it's not because I'm stubborn. They're not hitting the bullseye, except that one time, and that wasn't a book.
So let me ask this, though. We're talking about Google. We're talking about Amazon. Social media is a place where privacy, seems to have gone out the window, Bruce.
It's I'm ashamed to look at some of the Facebook posts. I have recently gotten on Facebook to find out. I'm coming up on whatever it is, my 40-year reunion, high school reunion. So I figure to get ready for it, I'll get on there and find my classmates and see who's going to be there.
Sure.
So it makes sense to me. But I am just shocked. I've seen more personal stories on Facebook that people shouldn't be sharing, from my perspective, than I do in the psychotherapy session. Mm-hmm. It's like,
well, from your perspective as a psychotherapist, I mean, do you actually think that people are getting their psychological treatment somehow from the universe by putting it out there on Facebook?
Not their psychological treatment.
Not good treatment, perhaps.
They're getting some need met, and I don't know what it is. It's just too much, and there is a group of people that will validate that kind of behavior, though. You know, very personal revelations of, you know, I saw recently a post from somebody who openly talked about how he thought his kid was doing the wrong thing, a young adult, and how, you know, he wished he had taught him more. It's like, you really want to tell that to the world? Do you really want to? Are you not embarrassed by your own revelation, no less imagining what your kid must feel like towards you? So that's the kind of thing that shocks me.
Well, when we come back, we're going to continue with Dr. Bruce Lease. We're going to turn from privacy to secrecy. What secrets do we keep? How does that affect us? We'll talk more about social media and other places where we tend to tell our secrets. How should we do it? If you want to spill it, or maybe you just have a question or a comment, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Don't forget, you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Somebody's watching. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We are talking today about secrets and privacy with Dr. Bruce Lease, our resident psychologist. We want you to be part of the conversation. When should you tell secrets? Has your life been affected by secrets? And when you have shared something that was a secret, was it a good outcome or maybe not such a good one? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. 88. Dr. Bruce Lease, let's talk about secrets. Are there good secrets to keep?
Well, we all desire. I'm gonna answer your question in a roundabout way.
I would expect nothing less.
We all desire closeness and intimacy and relationships and connectedness. Well, most of us do. Healthy people do. And the way we achieve that closeness is typically by sharing our secrets. Abuse as a child. So many people. One third of all families has some kind of family violence in it. And most people don't advertise that to the world. But one way of getting closer to somebody is to share something like that. You know, I saw my dad hit my mom might be a typical thing that somebody shares. So it's great to share secrets with people that you're trying to get close to. It doesn't have to be an intimate partner. It can be a new friend. That's how friendships develop. And a secret isn't a bad thing. It's very closely linked to privacy. It's the stuff we would keep private, but we're more intentional about it. And it's usually in the interpersonal domain. The only people who keep institutional secrets are perhaps terrorists and the people who say they're protecting us from those terrorists. Those
right.
are institutional secrets, but we share secrets because we want to get close to people.
In our personal lives, do you find in your work with patients or with people in general that some people are better at keeping secrets than others? And what goes into being a good keeper of secrets?
Yeah, people who gossip are terrible at keeping secrets. In fact, they violate all the rules of secret keeping. They talk about, they use secrets as currency to gain, you know, to gain friends and influence.
What's the appeal of that? I mean, why are some people simply gossips rather than good at keeping secrets?
To some extent, the people who gossip are people who aren't talking about their own frailty and their own idiosyncrasies and their own fallibilities. And it's easy. When I was a little boy, my mother taught me, you know, if people call you names, if they pick on you, it's because they want to feel better about themselves. That was wisdom that I got 50 years ago. And that's the wisdom that a gossip doesn't have. The sharing of that kind of personal secret as gossip is an effort to make yourself look big. And gossips are often gossiped about, which is an interesting twist.
Well, yeah, and I wonder, is there something different about sharing someone else's secret, which we might call gossip, and sharing your own secrets, revealing something about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, the difference is the vulnerability factor. Human beings don't want to feel vulnerable. Vulnerability is at the heart of anxiety and worry. The vulnerability is the fear of being weak, the fear of being hurt, the fear of being disappointed. So, we don't naturally as human beings let our guard down to be vulnerable and have the potential to get hurt.
Are there times, Bruce, when you would tell a patient or tell a client, you know, this is a time that it's okay to keep this secret? This is something
absolutely
you shouldn't be vulnerable about.
Absolutely. When people are doing something wrong and they are ready to tell that secret to get relief, the best example is an extramarital relationship, which an extramarital relationship is wrong. It's harmful. No matter how you try to squirm out from under it, it's harmful in many ways, and I won't get into those. But that's the kind of secret that sharing with one's partner could cause them more pain and suffering. So a secret that's told just for relief, not because the person is changed, that's not necessarily a good secret to share. So
when you're telling it to get something off your chest.
Exactly. Thank you for putting it that way. I couldn't have said it better.
on the other hand, there must be other times that you would say we really do need to get it off our chest. There's secrets we shouldn't try to keep.
Oh, we're starting a binge eating project at KU Med here in the near future. And binge eating is often a secret people keep, eating until one gets sick. Admitting to that, or heavy alcohol use, alcoholism, significant alcohol problems, those are secrets that people keep, where if they revealed those secrets, they might have second thoughts about engaging in those behaviors. Mm. A lot of people hide their cigarette smoking. Those secrets should be told so that people don't feel like they're doing it with impunity.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. If your life has been affected by secrets, for better or worse, give us a call, 816-235-2888. There's a lot of advantages to being more open, to not withholding that kind of information. One of the things that I've heard you talk about is our tendency to become sort of obsessed with the secret that we're keeping.
Yeah, a secret ends up having a life of its own. If we are trying to keep something private intentionally, instead of just revealing it, that becomes a lot of work. Binge eating, bulimia, good examples. The obsession itself grows and builds and builds and grows.
We're talking about privacy and security today on Central Standard. Let's talk to Ted in Kansas City, Missouri. Ted, welcome to the program. Ted, are you still with us? Ted is no longer there. Let's talk to Dina in Kansas City, Missouri.
So I agree and disagree on the whole secrets thing because, I mean, I have a boyfriend. I pretty much tell him everything. But there's certain things that I'm like, I don't quite feel comfortable telling everybody. Because people react to it, not very greatly. So I think it would really depend on who those secrets are going out to.
Okay, so Dina, what is the kind of thing that you would tell your boyfriend but not everybody? I'm not asking you to actually reveal the exact content of the secret here. But
Well, something like who I was dating is like, well, I'd like to know personally if you're going to tell somebody, because then I'll be ready for that bad reaction.
I see.
Like, I see these stories sometimes where even with like a senator or something, it's like, well, it's not, it is, it should be told because it's really not okay. But at the same time, I kind of disagree because I think that that's kind of wrong at the same time.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point to bring up, Dina. I appreciate your mentioning it. Dina called us at 816-235-2888. She mentioned public figures, a senator. Elliot Spitzer just got back into politics this week, said he's going to run for New York City comptroller. Of course, he had to leave politics when it was his secret was revealed that he was actually taking a customer of a prostitution ring while he was governor of New York.
For 1 year, I think he was in only for 1 year.
Right. But he was a rising star in American politics. But there was this very personal, very private thing going on in his life. In this case, it was also illegal. But what do you make of this tendency of people who have everything to lose still engaging in behavior that has to be kept secret?
Well, our problems are only as big as our secrets. To the extent we are doing things that we don't want anyone to know, we are probably engaging in some kind of misbehavior. Mm. So we hold our politicians up to high standards, and we are very disappointed when they don't meet those standards. And if they're going to be one of only 100 people who are our senators, they probably should hold themselves up to the highest standards, or one of 50 governors, the only president. That people should hold themselves to very high standards, and their secrets should be minimal. There shouldn't be anything we have to find out about them after they are elected.
Anything? So you say that when you enter into public life, you are relinquishing your right to privacy.
You know, that's a question I can't answer. But if I were in that domain, I would want everyone to know everything about me right up front, so I wouldn't get in trouble afterwards. That's mm-hmm. just my nature. I'd rather everybody know.
That's political advice, if nothing else.
That's personal. I don't know if it's policy.
But is it psychological too? I mean, is there some toll that it takes on our psyche to have everything out on the table that way?
I think that keeping secrets really limits a person's growth, well-being, mental health. I do, actually. Dina said earlier that she agrees and disagrees. Everything she said, I agree with, actually. What she was saying was, you don't tell everybody everything. You tell the closest people to you what you want to tell them, and you don't tell strangers everything. So I agree. I think that's a good standard. But if you're going to run for public office and you are doing something illegal or something that would distract you from leading, I think it's a good idea to let everyone know, or don't run for office.
Gene in Fairway has a question. Gene, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. As we said, it's more of a question. I just wondered if the guest thinks that, because I kind of think this, that with the advent of social media and technology so prevalent in our lives now, that what we once thought of as should have been private things are now just more public things. And it just seems that the culture has changed to now include things that at one time would have been just maybe a family secret or a personal secret. Now it's just right there on Facebook, or just people don't feel as private or privatized about certain things as they used to. And I'll take your comment off the air.
Gene, thank you so much for the call. That is an interesting question. We talked in the first half, Dr. Lease, about the way advertisers mine our social media content. But of course, he's asking, have we changed what we actually think is private? There was a time when a member of our family being diagnosed with a critical illness would be private, getting fired from our job would be private. But now, in the day of social media, those things aren't secret. People run straight to the internet and post it for all the world to see.
Yeah, there's no question that we reveal way more now publicly because there's a mechanism for doing so. There was an interesting study in a journal recently, and it was an international journal, and the study was of intergenerational differences in views of privacy and secrecy, intergenerational. Hmm. And they took the greatest generation, the people who lived, I don't have the exact years, I think who were born between 1928 and 40, whatever the years were, before 1928. So it was all the generations, Gen X, the millennia, the people in my generation, the baby boomers, and they really looked at whether there were differences in views of wiretapping and all that, and there really weren't. There is an increase in surveilling and looking at what people are doing, and there's an increase in sharing what we are doing, no doubt. But it's interesting that the generations aren't more or less paranoid over across multiple generations.
How about cultures? Different generations don't seem to show changes. Different cultures handle privacy differently, right?
I'm not a cultural anthropologist or a social psychologist, but I can tell you from traveling to Europe and to Asia and doing some teaching in those areas that my experience of people in Asia is that they're far more private than people in, say, the Netherlands. There's even things like nudity or things about when I was in Taiwan, if you were to use a toothpick, you used your other hand to cover up your mouth while you were using a toothpick. In America, there are people who walk around with toothpicks hanging out of their mouths thinking, well, doesn't everybody want to see that I'm picking my teeth? I mean, it's a difference in views of privacy and not so much secrecy. But so there are cultural differences. I can only speak from my experience.
Yeah, but sometimes matters of etiquette are really about community enforcing standards of what should be kept private.
Right. Covering up one's mouth while one uses a toothpick was an effort to keep it more private.
816-235-2888 is the number to call. Pam is calling us from Independence. Pam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the issue of, it sounds like you're kind of starting to touch on it, privacy versus secrets. We have two children who are adopted from China, and on our adoption trips, we shared the experience through social media and kind of struggled with how much of our kids' personal stories to keep private. And of course, you know, as they're growing up, we're sharing their own stories with them. But you know, there's that fine line between sharing everything and sharing nothing, and who do you share it with, and you know, who gets in kind of the circle of trust in terms of family or friends or whatever.
So, yeah, no, I appreciate that. Stick around, Pam. Maybe Dr. Lise can address that. Privacy with regard to your children is another issue, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Pam, since you're giving us a really healthy example of sharing information, you're talking about adoption, which is a wonderful thing for the people who adopt and the children who get adopted as they come into good, healthy homes. It's a beautiful thing. I'm curious about who you thought was interested in your story. And I'm not saying it wasn't interesting. I think it's a good example of something that's innocent to share. But I never know, and I really want the answer to that question, but I never know who would be interested in what I'm doing in my life. That's one of my reluctances to share. How did you know, and who did you think would be interested?
Well, with our first trip in 2006, we had a private invitation-only Yahoo group. And so we invited all the family and several of our close friends and allowed them to kind of come along with us. And even so, there were certain details that weren't shared in terms of the history of what relationship there was between our kids and their first parents.
Okay, can I want to interrupt to say that I think in that case that's wonderful, because a pregnant woman, when she shows, has all this social support, feedback, interaction. You know, how far along are you? How's the baby doing? How are you doing? When you adopt, you don't get that support, nurturing stuff from necessarily from the people that matter most in the world to you. So the way I think about your sharing on the private Yahoo group is that it was like going through, you know, it's similar to going through pregnancy, and the people who love you get to hear what your experience is like. So that really makes good sense to me. So please continue.
Yeah. With our second trip in 2008, I actually blogged the trip on a public blog, and I didn't restrict it. By that time, I'd made lots of online friends in the adoption community, and it was a little more difficult to get each person signed up to a private group. And, I, you know, we just made that choice to do it a little more publicly.
It sounds like you've asked yourself some good questions along the way to make sure you're doing it in a responsible way, Pam. So thank you so much for the call.
Sure. Thank you.
And Pam raises the point that, you know, even with the world of social media and even with the internet being available and public, there are still ways to show restraint. There are,
absolutely,
in fact, ways on Facebook, for example, to set up lists. You don't have to share every status with everybody. You can have an inner circle within your 1,000 friends.
And when you walk around pregnant, visibly pregnant, the public sees it. The whole world who sees you sees it. So, you know, from what Pam was saying, that there were no real unusual secrets being disclosed to the world. So to me, that's ideal use of social media if it worked well and she feels good about it and the family feels good about it.
So, Dr. Lease, if we have a listener who has a secret, maybe it's a health condition that they haven't disclosed, maybe it's sexual orientation, maybe it is something in their finances. If how would you advise someone who's debating whether they should be sharing this secret with, whether it be with family or with friends or with the world? What criteria should they be holding in their head? What questions should they be asking themselves before they decide whether to share that secret?
Oh, I like lists of questions. Let me see if I can come up with one quickly. Number one, am I reluctant to share because I'm doing something wrong? I mean, that'd be question number one.
And if that's the reason, does
stop
that mean
doing it.
They should stop doing
stop
it?
Stop misbehaving.
It's not about sharing.
If you're misbehaving and you don't want anyone to know, stop misbehaving. So that's number one. Don't do anything you wouldn't want to be published in, you know, the Kansas City paper or the Lawrence paper. Number two, assess the needs that you have regarding the secret if it isn't doing something wrong. If you're doing something that you know is morally and legally fine, but you're just ashamed of it, you know, just assess why it is you're not sharing it with anyone. That'd be part two or item two in my new list. Item three would be assess the potential rewards and punishments of sharing. And I'd go on real quickly here. Decide who you'd share it with and what the likely consequences are. And I would then assess the quality of my friendships. If I had something real personal, sexual orientation or something like that, that I wasn't sharing with people, I'd have to really look at my social network, even my family members, and say, why do we have such a secretive family? Or why do I feel so reluctant to talk to my friends about such personal things? I'm not doing anything wrong. So in my list, there'd be all kinds of things about assessing the secret, assessing my relationships, assessing the rewards and punishments. Tell the secret to somebody. It's good for you.
Well, let's explore that. Just how good is it? Lauren is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Hi, Lauren.
Hello. Well, I was calling. I have had the good fortune of, over time, people know that I'm a great secret keeper. And that really means a lot to me because I get to share with friends and family. They kind of get to unburden. And it means a lot to me that they trust me enough to share with secrets. Plus, I get to learn more about them and kind of about myself, too, as I think about their situations and how I might react in those same situations.
So tell us the last great secret someone told you.
I was going to say the last great secret was when a friend of mine who's in her 60s didn't share with her husband, friends, or family. I was literally the only person that she shared it with, and I could tell that she just needed to get it off her chest with somebody that she could trust. And to be honest, I mean, I was really honored that I was that person that she knew that it was going to go no further.
We're going to refrain from asking you what it was that she shared.
Oh, come on, Brian, do it, dude.
Lauren, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking
thank
the time
you.
To call us. And Lauren makes a good point. There is something to be said for the bonding or the relationship that happens between people when a secret is shared, when a trust is expressed.
That's how people get close. They share their deepest secrets, and they don't have secrets they have to carry around secretly so that people don't know who they are or you know, why they're close friends.
Not asking you to divulge inappropriate confidential details from your own work, but are there – can you think of some cases where secrets were being kept in ways that were very damaging to people?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that question. It's surprise. Oh, we did a show here years back, maybe a year ago, more than a year ago, and secrets came up, and a caller called in and said that she was trying to do something good for her husband. She was saving money and not telling him. And he was really offended that she, over several years, she was taking money and squirreling it away, and she surprised him with it. I think there are people who, and I'm thinking about people I see for therapy, the biggest things are relationships outside of one's primary intimate relationship. Another one is there are people who do things that they're ashamed of at work. They don't come home and tell their spouses that they're having a problem at work, and then they get fired, and they don't tell their spouse that they've been fired. I've known kids to drop out of college and go the rest of the year or further and not tell their parents that they've dropped out of college. Hmm. I know people who are depressed who don't tell anyone they're depressed, and they withdraw from everyone, and everyone wonders, where did they go? And people are annoyed when they hear, you know, you didn't talk to me. Mm. So are those good examples from your perspective?
Sure. How about with things like that we might call little white lies, but they involve keeping little secrets, whether it be a surprise party that's happening or what you've bought someone for their birthday. Are those kinds of secrets and sometimes the evasion or sometimes the lies that go with that?
It's
that
a balancing act. Your question's so good, I got excited and interrupted you. It's a great question. It's a balancing act. There are people who don't want surprise parties. They don't want surprises. And knowing the recipient is really important. I work with students, and, you know, I'll work with them for months and months and months. And I want to know their background. I want to know who they are. And I want them to tell me everything so I know who I'm working with. And the little white lies, I don't get impressed with those.
That's Dr. Bruce Leese. He's our resident psychologist here on Central Standard. I'm talking today about privacy and secrets. Dr. Bruce, always good to have you here.
It is always my pleasure. I thank you so much.
You can listen to earlier shows that we've had with Dr. Leese or any of our other programs. You can even listen to this program again. Go to the Central Standard page at kcur.org. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. We're exploring a video game that is changing how we view games and maybe even how we view human potential. Be sure you tune in. Stay tuned now for Up to Date. The Techsperts are here for the latest in technology news and gadgets. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Claire McInerney, Ross Steinmetz, and Sangeeta Shastri. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.